down to D.C. But I got my walking shoes on.
On my way to Washington.
I can't take a plane, bus or train, cause my money ain't that long. America,
we believe,
oh, that you love us dear.
You love us dear.
So people, I'm going up yonder.
Yeah.
This is Mark Steiner, and we're about to talk to Greg Kot, who's been a music critic at the Chicago Tribune since 1990, as a longtime contributor to Rolling Stone and many other national publications. Many of us have been reading him for years. His book we're going to talk about today, his new book, is I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples, The Staple Singers, and The March Up Freedom's Highway. And Greg Kot, welcome. Good to have you here on The Mark Steiner Show.
Mark, it's great to be here. Thank you.
This amazing book, I mean, Mavis Staples may be on the cover, but this is about the whole family. It's about a sojourn, because you begin this, really begin it with the roots of the family in Mississippi, with Pop Staples and his wife, and what their life was like as sharecroppers, and their parents, and that sojourn to Chicago is where you take us from the very beginning.
Yeah, I really think it was an opportunity to have a window into, a very important piece of our history, not only African-American history, but our country's history. And, you take the story of the Staples family back to, you know, the fact that Pops Roebuck Staples, his grandfather was a slave, and Pops himself grew up one of 14 kids on a sharecropping farm in Mississippi. You know, his first childhood memories is his mother dying when he was 5 years old. I mean, it was a very hard life. And, you know, at the same time, he was at Dockery Farm in Mississippi, where he had the opportunity to see people like Howlin' Wolf and Charlie Patton as they were developing their formulation of the modern blues as we know. I mean, he learned guitar by watching Charlie Patton play at Dockery Farm, which is an extraordinary opportunity for any young man, you know. And taking it north, you know, after that and forming the Staple Singers. I mean, it's an amazing story.
You know, when you just said that what you just described about how he learned to pick a guitar, this family's entire life was built around some of the most amazing musicians and activists in the country. And their life, just starting with Charlie Patton, their
right.
lives just collectively and individually just wandered through all of them, so many of them. It's an unbelievable tale.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people know pieces of the story, but then when you connect all the pieces, it's pretty extraordinary, and it's almost Zelig-like, you know, at every historic moment of the African-American community, the formulation of the blues, the diaspora north, the explosion of gospel music in the 40s and 50s, you know, especially in Chicago, and then being at the heart of it with one of the biggest songs of that era in On a Cloudy Day, then stepping right into the civil rights era where Pop Staples and Martin Luther King were best of friends. I mean, Martin Luther King used to have the Staples Singers essentially open for him when he was giving his civil rights speeches. And there was a reason that when he first brought the movement north, you know, he chose Chicago, and the Staples Singers were his handpicked group to help lead the charge. You know, the relationship with Bob Dylan and the crossover with the folk movement, pretty extraordinary stuff. And then, you know, the last act, really, with Mavis reinventing herself as a solo artist, that was a major step for her after her father died in 2000, and essentially putting herself back on the cultural radar by herself. I mean, she had to self-finance her first record because nobody wanted a Mavis Staples record at that point. And now here she is back again, big as ever in many ways, and making music, I think, more importantly, on the level of the best music that she's made in her career. And I can't think of too many artists in their 70s who can make that claim, but Mavis is certainly up there.
Well, there's no question. And I think, you know, when you talk about their going to Chicago and everything from who Pop Staples played with when he was working in those factories and the great artists that he came in touch with, to the fact you have a piece in here, he talks about when Purvis Staples says, Lou Rawls, Sam Cooke, his brother L.C., we all went to the same grammar school. I mean,
yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. I mean, what a grammar school, right? Sam Cooke and Lou Rawls and all these great singers. You know, Mahalia Jackson was a frequent visitor at the house. You know, I love the stories about, you know, the schoolgirls gathering at the church across the street from the school on the south side of Chicago on Sunday afternoons, where there would be a battle of the bands, you know, and the Sam Cooke band would battle the Lou Rawls band, and you know they were and Purvis Staples was right in the middle of it too, and the girls would all fawn after the boys. They were supposed to be singing gospel and religious songs, but the girls weren't thinking about God when they were watching Sam Cooke sing, you know. And this is when he's 12, 13, 14 years old, you know. It's a great window into, and nobody knew at the time that they were going to change the world, you know, but it was this you could see that they were learn, you know, there was this great melting pot of influences going on at the same time that explains the kind of music that these people made later on in their lives when their voices had matured and they had come into the public spotlight. These people had been singing all their lives and honing their craft and making each other better.
Yeah, how their lives were interconnected and affect each other's music and each other's lives, we're going to continue with when we come back. We're talking here with Greg Kot, this incredible book, and the music you're hearing under us now that goes with it. I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples, the Staples Singers, and the March on Freedom's Highway. We're going to come back and talk about WEA, why this book makes you happy, and why WEA makes you happy.
Paul and Silas, bound in jail, had no money but to go their bail. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
Who wrote this incredible book, I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples, the Staples Singers, and the March Up Freedom's Highway. Of course, he is the music critic of the Chicago Trib since 1990, and has written for Rolling Stone and many other magazines over the years as well, covering all the music that we love. And so Greg, we touched on a couple of things. There's a couple of influences I do want to touch on here that I think that are pretty profound in her life and in the life of the Staples Singers. But in terms of Mavis Staples, one was Mahalia Jackson,
family friend.
I mean, tell that story. It's how, because she, as you wrote, revolutionized gospel, but also revolutionized the way Mavis Staples approached music.
Right. Her father was a big fan of quartet singing, which was the core of gospel music. And the quartet singers were primarily male voices. So Mavis grew up around hearing a lot of male voices in the house. Her dad would play records all the time. And, you know, he taught Mavis and her siblings the four-part harmonies that he had been developing since he was a kid himself, singing these gospel quartet harmonies. But, you know, the introduction of a female voice into that lexicon was Mahalia. You know, hearing Mahalia Jackson for the first time was a revelation to Mavis when she's 6, 7, 8 years old, you know, like, immediately it struck her as something different than she'd been exposed to that point, and she was just mesmerized by the voice. And then, you know, it so happened that Mahalia lived only a few blocks from the family home. They struck up a friendship with Pops. Mahalia was quite taken with this young group, you know, the children up on the you know singing from the church pulpit with their father. She was quite charmed by this young group, and Mavis in particular, because Mavis was sort of a precocious kid and wasn't afraid to come up to Mahalia and tell her how much she admired her. And she thought, you know, the first time that she met Mavis, she felt like Mahalia, she felt like she was meeting the queen, because Mahalia had this would always have this done-up hair where it was this towering beehive, and she had these beautiful jeweled gowns. She felt like she was meeting a member of royalty. But at the same time, she was not afraid to tell Mahalia how much she loved her, and says, "You're going to hear my voice because I sing real loud." And Mahalia was just, you know, very charmed by this young lady and became a mentor of sorts. You know, Mahalia and the great gospel singers could be very cutthroat if they wanted to be. You know, there was, you know, for all the high-minded nature of what they were singing about, there was sort of a lot of cutthroat competition among the gospel singers. You know, you didn't take the crown away from the queen without a fight, you know. But Mahalia never viewed Mavis as a threat. She always thought of her as kind of a niece and was very attentive to Mavis. You know, she would, you know, tell her, like, "Hey, you can't go out in the cold after you sung like that. You need to change your top.
Put on a new shirt, put on a new jacket." Right.
Yeah,
right,
exactly. Right. So it was kind of this motherly advice that she was passing along. And she would show up at the family home, you know, for these backyard barbecues, which still blows my mind. You've got Albertina Walker and Jesse Jackson and Jesse Owens and Jim Mudcat Grant just hanging out in my backyard on July 4th, you know, because they all came from Mom's cooking. And Mahalia would say things, you know, Mahalia was just Hallie to Mavis and her family. You know, she could, you know, you would always see Mahalia in these beautiful gowns, with her hair all done up when she was performing. But at the Jackson's house, she would show up in a sundress and sandals. And she would have Mavis, you know, "Hey, honey, come and get, could you bring Hallie, you know, some of Mom's ice cream?" And then, you know, she'd bring the homemade ice cream to Mavis or to Mahalia, and Mahalia would put a little gin on top of it, you know, for a little, you know, a little July 4th refreshment. You know, it was that kind of relationship. And extraordinary when Mahalia was near the end of her life, she and Mavis were performing together at this big outdoor concert in Harlem in 1969. And Mahalia was the closing act, and she wasn't feeling very well that night. And she was in the middle of the performance, and, you know, Mavis was up there on the stage just sitting on the chairs next to the stage because they would always cheer on each other. You know, it was part of the gospel tradition that once you performed, you would stay on stage to sort of clap along with the next performer to make it feel like church, as Mavis said. And Mahalia came over to her and said, you need to help me with this next one, because she knew it was going to be a performance that required a certain amount of vocal power that she just wasn't able to summon at that moment. So she literally passed the microphone to Mahalia. It was this amazing moment. It's on film where she hands the microphone to Mahalia, Mavis, and says, you know, it's your turn now. It's your turn to take over. And 2 years later, Mahalia was dead. But, you know, it was one of those moments that just sort of burned in people's memory that day, including Mavis herself, that she'll never forget, because it was kind of this symbolic passing of the torch from one great gospel singer to the next generation.
And that, to me, was just an amazing piece of this book. I mean, I, like many people, I grew up on Mahalia Jackson, and then seeing the relationship she had with Mavis Staples was, which is, I mean, unreal. I mean, could you describe the way Mahalia transformed gospel music into her world, the way she wanted to sing it? And just, and then when I listen to Mavis Staples now, because of your book and thinking about these things, I can hear the influences that she had in her life.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, they grew up on this stuff, and the fact that you were able to, you know, not only listen to that person, but, you know, talk to them about what they did and watch them perform countless times, you know, the cadences and everything. It's not just hearing somebody sing, but hearing how they talked and how they spoke about what they did. You know, this whole notion of the Holy Ghost coming into the room, you know, I mean, that was a huge, huge part of this culture that they were coming from. And it influenced Mavis, you know. It was like, you know, you improvise in the moment. You find the Spirit. The Spirit comes to you, and you have to sort of, you know, wait for that moment. And it enabled Mavis to be very, very adaptable. You know, there was no one way to sing a particular song. You could sing it multiple ways. And she learned this by watching Mahalia sing. Mahalia was always, always, always in the moment. There was never the same version of the song when she was, you know, when she was feeling it, and Mavis carried that through her life. Now you can go see a Mavis performance, and no two shows will be exactly alike, because Mavis is reacting. She's living that song in real time and responding to it in real time, which is something that she learned from Mahalia.
So in the couple minutes that we have before we go to break, Greg, I do want to bring up Dylan and many of the things and Martin Luther King and maybe it's a solo career. We'll get into all that in the next parts of our program. But I'm just curious, after finishing the book, describe just to me, to our listeners, how you think of Mavis Staples.
Well, I think of her as one of a kind. I one of the reasons I really, really wanted to write this book was that she's a national treasure, and they ain't making people like this anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, what she's seen in her life, the ground that she's covered, not only artistically but culturally, is extraordinary. We have a window through her eyes of an incredible period in our history, you know, from the slave era to modern times, and how that music sustained the African-American community through that, helped them sort of, you know, reach this level, this extraordinary level of, you know, we can make it if we try, so to speak, to quote another famous lyric, you know. And, you know, her mission's not done. I think one of the big reasons that she, you know, restarted her musical career after Pops died, even though she was incredibly depressed about it, was that she realized, you know, her father's message, because her father was big on, you know, what is the music saying? That work was not done yet. There was more to be done. And I think she's going to go to the very end, you know, believing that. And this is what's kind of firing her up. You go see Mavis now, and she is still this incredibly cheerful, powerful presence. You know, I talked to one of her singers, and he says, you know, I'm not really a believer. You know, I'm not like a, I would not call myself a godly person, especially when I first met Mavis. But then, you know, just being around her, it's never a bad day. You know, it's kind of like everything feels better after you meet Mavis. It's kind of this incredible thing. And I've been around her long enough to realize she has this powerful impact on people. And it's just this, I can't describe it other than to say this incredible warmth radiating from her. And you see her sing, you see her talk. The person you see on stage is exactly the same person she is off the stage. And believe me, I've interviewed enough artists to know that is not true well over 90% of the time. And she's the rare exception to that. You know, she's an extraordinary, she would be an extraordinary person even without the music. But when you bring the music into it, it's just, she really is a remarkable. I really feel fortunate to be sharing the same planet with Mavis Staples, you know, while I've had a chance.
Amen to that. And we are here talking with Greg Kot. His great new book, I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples, The Staples Singers and the March Up Freedom's Highway. And we got much more to cover. And that song, Singing Under Us, of course, you know what that is. It makes you happy. So this fun drive. We'll be right back.
And put the load right on, me.
Yeah. Keep talking about the president, won't stop our pollution.
Welcome back, folks, and we are, of course, talking with Greg Kot about his great new book, I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples, The Staples Singers, and the March Up Freedom's Highway. We're just so happy to have him here with us, especially during our fun drive, but also just because this is just an amazing book. And Greg, you know, one of the things, there's so much ground to cover in the short time we have today because of the fun drive, but there's a couple places I really want to take us there, if I can coin such a word.
The phrase. Sure.
One is, I mentioned Bob Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
This relationship that Bob Dylan had with Mavis Staples, but also with the entire family back and forth, musically and other ways, and how it was just amazing to read how this, in the beginning, Bob Dylan kind of fell in love with the Staples Singers even before he knew them.
Right. He was, you know, growing up in northern Minnesota, he would tune in this. He was an avid music fan, and he would tune in a lot of the southern R&B and gospel stations. And he could hear them, you know, these 50,000-watt powerful signals, you know, late at night. And, you know, the Staples Singers even then stood out. He was just haunted by the sound. If you compare what the Staples Singers were doing in the late 50s on the VJ label to a lot of what gospel music was sounding like in that era, they are very stark contrast. They have almost this solemn nostalgic, very southern, very rural sound amid these very up-tempo kind of gospel songs that were popular during that time. And their voices just sounded otherworldly, and Dylan was mesmerized by it. When he finally met the group in 1962, it was went to a gospel festival with his friend Robert Shelton, the New York Times writer who became Dylan's first biographer. He met Mavis for the first time, and he was just awestruck by her beauty. Immediately fell in love with her, and actually asked her to marry him a few months later, even before they had begun romancing or there had been any kind of dating involved, which was very funny to Pops because he approached Pops first in this cafeteria line that they were at while they were taping this this TV show in New York in early 63, and said, "Pops, I want to marry Mavis." He says, "Well, why are you asking me? She's standing right here." But they did have a relationship. A few months later, they had their first kiss at the Newport Folk Festival, famous festival in '63, where I think that was a crucible moment for the civil rights movement, where the folk and the gospel worlds came together. And then a few months later, you had Martin Luther King giving his famous March on Washington speech, the "I Have a Dream" speech, and symbolically, Mahalia Jackson and Bob Dylan and Joan Baez all performed that day. You could see these two movements coming together. But the Staple Singers were the first group outside of the folk movement to perform Dylan songs. And the reason for that was that Pops heard in Dylan, he goes, what can this scrawny kid, white kid from northern Minnesota tell me about my life? And then Purvis would say, "No, Pops, you got to listen to this song." And was blown in the wind. "How many roads must a man walk down before they call him a man?" And Pops was just amazed that this kid could, in a few words, could describe the struggle that he was feeling. And immediately they embraced Dylan, not only as a friend, a fan of the group, but also as an important songwriter who was exactly in step with what they were feeling and what the civil rights movement needed at that moment. So it was a pretty powerful combination. And, the marriage proposal got turned down. Mavis told me that her biggest regret of her life was that she did turn down Dylan, and she said she did it in part because she wondered what Martin Luther King would have thought of an interracial marriage. And now she realized, I was just silly. He wouldn't have looked down on it.
Exactly.
It is amazing because the relationship has endured to this day. I got a story from Jeff Tweedy of Wilco last year. He was on tour with Dylan. And Tweedy had obviously produced the last couple of Mavis records. And he said to Dylan, he said, "Oh, by the way, Mavis says hi." And Dylan responded to Tweedy, said, "Tell Mavis she should have married me back then." And I don't think he was kidding around.
Right.
Yeah.
I love that story. I mean, I think that, and it's also, I mean, the music they put on some of their early albums and just kind of, the way they translated it. It's really hard to find some of those albums now that they made of those early Dylan pieces. But that was just, it fed into kind of how progressive they were in many ways as Staple Singers. Mm-hmm. Pop Staples kind of moving out, and you talk about how he was criticized some because he did bring folk music into their world.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the gospel purists, the gospel police were out in force when the Staple Singers strayed across the line, started moving into secular music. But Pops contended for years, and accurately so, that there isn't a single song that we've done that I don't believe could be sung in church as well. That was very true throughout the 60s, even though they were performing so-called more secular music. Pops had a very big transformation after he met Martin Luther King, because he realized, we're singing about the afterlife, we're singing about, getting through the day, getting through our lives so that we can enjoy finally our just reward in heaven, in the afterlife. And kind of thinking, his thinking changed when he met King. He realized, we have to make a better life for ourselves here too, and these songs can help us do that. And he shifted his perspective, embraced what was being sung in the folk movement. And Pops himself became a very important songwriter in the civil rights era. I mean, Why Am I Treated So Bad? Songs like that, along those lines. I like the things about me. You know, these songs of self-empowerment, these songs of, you know, transcending what's happening to us now so that there will be a better day, but a better day here on earth, not something that we have to wait for. It says we can make it happen for us now. And, you know, it was a vital part of it. There was a lot of energy in the songwriting because of that. And I think I hope the book makes people realize what a visionary Pop Staples was. Because
that's so important.
Exactly. His ability to sort of visualize that it wasn't just pure gospel, but it could be all of these things. You know, as Duke Ellington said, it's gospel in a blues key. You know, as long as you had Pop's guitar in there, you had a little Charlie Patton in there. So it was already a bit of a hybrid, you know? And then when it started melding with the folk and later on with the soul and even the rock, I mean, John Fogerty says that Pop Staples was probably his biggest influence as a guitar player. You know, Ry Cooder, Bonnie Raitt, these Keith Richards, you know, This could be the last time. The riff, he said, yeah, I took it straight off of Pop's record.
The band.
You know, the band. Their harmonies were basically inspired by the Staples singers' harmonies. There's a reason that the Staples were asked to perform The Wait, which to me is the showpiece moment of the last waltz in the mid-70s when the band finally staged its last concert. It's because that song and the way it was harmonized, those harmony vocals, the way that the leads were being traded off by Danko Helm and Manuel was directly inspired by the Staples singers.
There's so much here. I mean, I do appreciate the book deeply because it's expanded my understanding. I've always loved the Staples singers. Always loved Mavis Staples, but the depth of who they were and the world they traveled through, you don't get until you read this book. And we're talking right now to Greg Cotton. Of course, the book we're talking about is "I'll Take You There," Mavis Staples, the Staples Singers, and the March Up Freedom's Highway, which can be yours for a pledge of $100 here at WEAA at 410-319-8888. And we're going to come back to talk more with Greg Cott. Enjoy the music. Be happy with this. We'll be right back.
A broken home, a broken heart, isolated and afraid. Open up, this is the rain. I wanna get it through to you. Oh, they tell me.
Welcome back, folks. We're here with Greg Cott, of course, who is the music critic at the Chicago Tribune since 1990. And we're talking about his latest book, an amazing piece of work, I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples, The Staples Singers, and The March Up Freedom's Highway. And you've been hearing her riffs and their riffs all the way through this conversation. You know, one of the things that there's so many threads that run through this book. One of them you talked about before we went to break, which was this blues-gospel divide. And the relationship between the two, the Pop Staples, was always in the middle of and thought about. And the other, I think, that really struck me in this book is the entire family. There was no mistake why they were close to Martin Luther King and at the forefront of the civil rights movement. That the legacy, I forget the exact quote you had in the book, Greg, but you'll remember it, I'm sure. It had to do with being sharecroppers and, you know, you watch your step, but you never bow down. I wrote it down. I can't remember where I just put it, but it was that they were always kind of stand up, proud, not backing away,
right,
and believed in that power.
Right. Yeah. Don't take nothing. You know, I can't remember the exact quote either, but it was one of Pop's sayings. There's many. He had many words of wisdom. It was the whole idea of that. You know, you don't look for a fight, but you don't back down from one either.
Right.
That was basically the notion behind it. And you know, he was a tough guy. I mean, one of the things that people don't realize is that the Staples Singers, one of their most lasting legacies is that they were one of the few groups that traveled the back roads of the South in the early 60s. I mean, they were going through the back roads of Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana to play gigs. I mean, even Sam Cooke's guitar player was saying, man, we would go to the big cities where we knew we could be relatively secure, Memphis, Jackson, et cetera, but we did not want to do any of those rural type of locations, you know, because we knew that we were asking for trouble on the road. And it was just Pops and his girls, and basically, and Purvis. And here they were, this family, driving around in a Cadillac, you know, raising all sorts of eyebrows, you know, because who are these uppity black folks think they are driving around in this Cadillac, you know? So right away, they were targets. But Pops would take no guff. I mean, there were, you know, he did carry a gun, you know? Mm-hmm. And if push came to shove, you know, he would, you know, it would be there. He never had to kill anybody or shoot anyone, but it was always, you know, it was there if he needed to use it. Occasionally whites would try to drive them off the road just for fun. Mavis would say Pops would drive right back into him. You know, he wouldn't hightail it out of there. He would say, you know, what are you doing? You know, get out of my grill. You know, you don't need to get into my space. So Pops was a tough guy, and it was great to hear Dorothy Tillman, a former alderman in Chicago, who spoke at Cleety Staples' funeral a couple of years ago. She mentioned she'd grown up in Alabama. She was part of King's civil rights movement. She said, we never forgot. The Staples always came. You know, everybody else stayed away because there were the lynchings, and there was such a bad reputation for African-Americans, especially from the North, to come to the rural South. But the Staples were there for us. They sang for us, and we will never forget that. And it was a really powerful moment. It was one of the most powerful moments of that funeral, to hear that decades later, that dedication to their people still resonated with them. It was never forgotten.
You know, even to the point where and the one of the comeback records, at least maybe it wasn't comeback, but you can describe it to us, from Mavis Staples, was the which she did with Ry Cooder, "We'll Never Turn Back," which was another kind of powerful social political statement she was saying about the freedom movement in this century.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love that album.
Yeah, that was that to me was the one that, like, wow, that's. You know, that was the one where you kind of realized, thank God she's come back and done these solo recordings. Ry Cooder read her perfectly. First of all, he was a huge fan of Pops. He had helped record some of Pops' music in the 90s when he won his first Grammy Award for his solo recordings. And he had been seeing the Staple Singer since the 60s. And it was the idea of Anti Records They were the ones that suggested to Mavis that she kind of revisit some of these songs from her earliest days in the 60s as part of that civil rights movement. It was a brilliant idea because once Mavis started to think about it, she said, you know what, in some ways this message is still necessary. We're still seeing, you know, this abuse. We're still seeing racism. We're still seeing, you know, this is in the wake of the Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
A disaster, and you know, the feeling that somehow a community was abandoned because of class and cultural and racial differences, and it was never so explicit, but it was a feeling that we're still not on par with everything. There is no real equality in this country, even though we pay lip service to it.
Right.
And it was a powerful message to be sent at that time. I mean, I think that record, more than any one, was the one that told people, wow, this is, first of all, this is an incredibly powerful performer, but also look at the history that she's had. I mean, she, of anyone who has the right to sing these songs, she is the one. And she brought such a power to those songs. And then, you know, the other part of that equation was, I think, with that record, she retooled her band, and she's got this amazing band now that began playing with her on the road after that "We'll Never Turn Back" album came out, and I think that's really set her down the right path, where she's in a comfort zone now, where she feels exactly at home. The sound of that guitar, the fact that her sister Yvonne is in the group, part of the backing harmonies, it's a very familiar comfort zone for her, and she's making some of the best music of her life because of it.
Well, Greg Kot, one more time, I just want to say thank you so much for reading this book, and it's just an amazing piece of work, and it opens so much new territory when it comes to the world of Mavis Staples, our social cultural history in America, the history of music, the world of blues and gospel, how it all intertwined, the incredible lives that the Staples singers were intertwined with. I can't say enough about this book. And we've been talking about We'll Never Turn Back. You listen to Down in Mississippi Under Us right now, and I'll take you there. Mavis Staples, the Staples Singers, and the March Up Freedom's Highway. And Greg Cott, once again, thank you so much for writing this book and sharing it with our listeners for this fun drive.
A pleasure, Mark. Thanks for the in-depth interview. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.